Hey there, everyone. Welcome to the Developmental Disabilities Network Journal Author Insights Podcast. I'm Dr. Matthew Wappett, the host of the podcast, and it's my pleasure to join you today. This podcast, I say it every single time, is one of my favorite things I get to do because I learn so much talking with these authors who publish in the Developmental Disabilities Network Journal. It's also fun because it helps me learn, it helps me understand what's happening out there in the field, and I hope that I'm able to bring some of that to you so that you're able to also gain a wider appreciation for some of the work that's happening out there. So just by way of introduction and why we do this podcast, I think it's important to note that the podcast is part of our ongoing commitment to increasing the accessibility of the information that we put out through the Developmental Disabilities Network Journal. Not everyone has time to sit down to read a book or an article, and in fact, more and more people are getting their information through audio sources, podcasts, through audiobooks, things like that, video even. And so as we move as a culture towards more multimedia ways of sharing information, we're trying to keep up with the trends, which is why we've started this podcast and try to help you access the same information you'd get in the journal, maybe in a more fun, accessible format here through these podcast recordings. So with that said, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed. This is a regular ongoing series. So we try to interview as many authors as we can from each past issue of the journal, and we try to put out a few per year. It is a labor of love, though, and we're not always as consistent as we would like, but, you know, we're getting there. So anyway, if you like to listen to podcasts, you can subscribe to the Author Insights podcasts on most major platforms. So Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Overcast, Podbean, wherever it is. Also, if you're there, please leave us a rating and a review and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. That helps raise the visibility of this work and the authors who we speak to. So with that said, we are excited today to have an interview with Richard Chapman and Jessica Shuttler, who were authors on an article in the most recent issue of the Developmental Disabilities Network Journal called Applying the Self-Determined Learning Model of Instruction to the Psychotherapeutic Context for People with Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. Now, I know that's a highly academic title, but I think you will find this interview to be not quite as academic as the title. Richard has been a friend for the past couple of years, and I find him incredibly fun to visit with, and it was great to have Jessica, his colleague, with us. And I think you'll find it's more of a relaxed exploration of what is self-determination and how do we support people with living self-determined lives. So, by way of introduction, Richard Chapman, Dr. Richard Chapman, is the Associate Director for Disability Leadership at the Partnership for People with Disabilities at Virginia Commonwealth University, the USET out there. He completed a postdoctoral research fellowship at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas, where he studied self-determination and assessment. And a lot of that work that he did in Canvas is what has informed this article. Richard considers himself a disability studies scholar. He conducts research in the area of self-determination. He's also a licensed mental health counselor and a certified rehabilitation counselor. He got a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a PhD, all from the University of South Florida, and he currently lives in Richmond, Virginia. Now, his colleague, Jessica Shuttler, is a child psychologist and assistant professor at the University of Kansas Medical Center in the Division of Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics. She also is the training director for the Kansas LEND, or the Leadership Education and Neurodevelopmental Disabilities Program. She works with children, youth, and young adults to provide therapy and interdisciplinary developmental evaluations. And her role in the LEND program includes teaching and coordinating training experiences for emerging emerging leaders from over 10 different disciplines to encourage more interdisciplinary work as we support kids with disabilities who are coming through our systems. So anyway, I hope that you find this conversation informational. I hope you find it useful. It really was a pleasure to speak with Richard and Jessica. So without further ado, let's jump into this fun and informative conversation.
So I'm excited to be here today to visit with Richard and Jess about their article in the most recent issue of the Developmental Disabilities Network Journal, Applying the Self-Determined Learning Model of Instruction to the Psychotherapeutic Context for People with Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. Now that is a mouthful. So, Richard, let's start with you. Please tell us a little bit about your background and how did you come to the work that you discuss in this DDMJ article?
Well, Matt, thank you very much for inviting Jess and I to do the podcast and stuff. So my background is actually mental health counseling. I started, in 2010, working with persons that are homeless and then also in domestic violence. But in 2015 or 16, I did something foolish. I went back to school and got my PhD in counseling education and supervision. When I went back to get my PhD, I thought that I was not going to focus on disability, on disability issues. As a side note, I identify as a person with lived experience that has cerebral palsy. I didn't want to be put into a box, but you know, stuff happens. And I did my dissertation in the area of self-advocacy in college students with disabilities. And then I had a great fortune of going out to the University of Kansas to do a postdoctoral fellowship in self-determination intervention and assessment under the direction of Dr. Kelly Shogren and I met Jessica, and this was during the time of COVID, so it was very difficult for all of us, and Jessica was doing some fun and innovative projects in the area of self-determination, and I joined our team, and we began to conceptualize this model. I don't know if Jessica, you want to add anything, but that's kind of what it is in a nutshell.
No, that's great. Thanks, Richard. So Jessica, you were at Kansas when Richard came out for his postdoc. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved with this project.
Sure. Yeah. So I have been a psychologist in practice in our developmental pediatrics division at the University of Kansas Medical Center since about 2016. And I kind of, in terms of my psychology career, was kind of born and raised at KU. I did my graduate work there and had the opportunity to be a LEN trainee and a pre and postdoctoral fellow at KU in their developmental pediatrics division as well. So I'd been working there for a few years and also had the opportunity in 2017 to move into our training director role for our Kansas Lend program. And we've had a lot of strong collaborations in our Lend program with our, you said, with the Kansas University Center on Developmental Disabilities for a number of years. But as I was kind of growing and learning in my training director role and my psychologist role, I was thinking more and more about these concepts of self-determination that we were talking about a lot in educational contexts and in, you know, more community employment kinds of contexts. But as a person whose primary kind of working context was in therapy and working with kids and young people with autism and other developmental disabilities, I was kind of asking myself, how can we bring these things together? And so reached out to Carrie Shogren, who mentored Richard and I in a number of ways, but especially related to this paper, to kind of talk more about these ideas. And she said, well, you really need to meet Richard. And she kind of brought us together. And then we've had the opportunity to start collaborating virtually. I think it probably was like, I don't know, Richard, like 6 months maybe before we saw each other like in real life, in person. But we had a lot of fun, like brainstorming and Zooming.
I think it was more than that. I think it was more like, I guess, October, November to August. So like 8 or 9 months. I don't know.
Yeah. It was too long. Yeah. I know that. So then this paper is kind of like, kind of the product, I guess, of some of those early collaborative conversations and thinking together.
Yeah, so this isn't a question that I included, but you both brought it up. It sounds like you started this work at the beginning of COVID. Is that true?
We started this work in October 2020, COVID, and I moved to do a postdoc in the middle of COVID, which was probably on a personal level one of the hardest things I've ever done because of the isolation, being single in a new city. So I was desperately looking for collaborators.
Yeah. So I mean, that's one of the interesting things that we're finding with articles that are coming out now, that they occurred, the research and the writing and everything occurred during COVID. Did you find that the pandemic affected your approach and kind of how you implemented and gathered data and wrote and everything? And if so, what were some of those effects of the pandemic? We can go to you, Jessica, for that one.
That's a good question. I was kind of waiting to see what Richard said, because I was like, I'll say my work has been, I've been wearing my kind of clinician and teacher's hat and haven't done as much manuscript writing and proposal writing, but in some ways, I think with some of the downtime that we had, or the lack of other demands to some, I mean, we had different demands maybe I wouldn't say maybe not lack, but the different kind of the different things we were dealing with, we had kind of different relationships with time. And so maybe there were like more opportunities to kind of sit back and think about that all a bit. I mean, using Zoom and thinking about ideas and sharing ideas was maybe different than, you know, like sitting in a room and brainstorming or like writing on a whiteboard together, things like that. But also Richard's a really personable person to work with. And so made it, you know, we were always laughing and kind of enjoying ourselves too through the process. So that was a great plus, I think.
And I just had to change the way I worked during the pandemic. And I'm going to confess something. I walked out of my house masked up during the pandemic. I walked out of grocery stores and coffee shops, and maybe Kiri doesn't know that, or maybe she does, but I'm And so that's how I worked, and it was really trying to find dedicated writing time.
I find also that it's easier for me to write in public. You know, when I'm home, I get too distracted. And so sometimes being in a coffee shop or something helps me actually be a little more focused. I don't know what it is. I don't know. You're the psychologist. You could probably tell me why that is.
Well, it's funny because I realized how much I appreciated the quiet and the space of working from home and being at home. Like I did a lot of it from right here where I'm talking with you from. So, and I think I don't know if this applies exactly to the writing of this paper, but I think we all kind of figured out different ways about ourselves, how we work best or what we need to work through stress or work or take care of our stress instead of work, trying to find that balance, I think is something all of us continue to work on. But thank you for that question. I hadn't really thought about that in terms of this kind of work before. So
no, it's been really interesting for us at least, because COVID had a significant impact, especially on human subjects research and what you could do and what you couldn't do. And it changed a lot of the dynamics. And so, you know, the work that's done during the pandemic is just starting to come out. And so it's interesting to see how people adapted to those particular demands. So anyway, thanks for sharing. I appreciate that. That was not a planned question, but there it is. So let's turn to your article really quick here. Your article talks about the self-determined learning model of instruction and then applying that to the psychotherapeutic context. You kind of explained how you came to this topic, but maybe dig in a little bit more. What is the self-determined learning model of instruction and why is it so important? And Richard, why don't we start with you on that one?
You would do that.
I would. Yep.
Yeah. So, before I get into the self-determined learning model of instruction, could we take a step back and define what we mean by self-determination? Because I think that if people don't understand what self-determination is, they are not going to get the idea of the self-determined learning model of instruction. We hear this idea of self-efficacy, self-determination, self-advocacy, and sometimes people use those words interchangeably, but really self-determination is this idea of causing or making things happen in your own life. They're really When we define self-determination, we define it from the lens causal agency theory. So the SDLMI or the self-determined learning model of instruction is a way to promote goal setting and self-determination in a variety of population. It's built on a lot of the work of Michael Waymire, who kind of developed the SDLMI, and then more recently, Kelly Shogren has done a huge amount of work on the SDLMI and on causal agency theory in general. So it's really an intervention meant to promote self-determination. Jessica, I don't know if I've missed anything, but that's what I think.
I would just, I also think about it as, you know, everything you said, Richard, but also like kind of a framework that you can apply to different context. So it's been applied in like classroom context to support students of all abilities in being able to decide upon a goal, decide on a plan for how they're going to achieve that goal, and then kind of self-reflect and examine progress towards that goal, what they've learned about themselves, and kind of, you know, promoting those sorts of skills and abilities. And then has also been applied in other kinds of contexts. But really the idea is, you know, there's a set of kind of person questions, there's facilitator objectives that, so we're all guided by the person question. So the questions being asked of our focus person, whether that's a student or a client in therapy in our case, right? And asking, you know, facilitators are asking questions or seeking to support the answering of these questions around what a person wants to have happen in their life and what their plans could be of how to get there and what supports or other kinds of actions they might need to take to make those things happen. And then there's, I think, the other really kind of helpful thing about that framework and thing that's really cool that we tried to kind of share in the article was about the educational supports that are kind of packaged within it too. So it kind of offers people, like in our case, therapists, in the context we're thinking about, offers therapists some tools and strategies to think about using within those interactions. And as they're talking through those questions with a client, that can help ensure understanding, accessibility, and that we're really hearing the voice and the perspectives of the person who's the focus or of our client. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like it's a tool, right, that can be applied in various contexts. It's not necessarily strictly limited to just the therapeutic interaction, right? A therapist's office or whatever. It could be used in a classroom or in a community setting.
And it's primarily been used in the classroom and the community setting, and it hasn't really been used in the therapeutic context. And our team was proposed this.
Yeah, no, and that's where I think it's interesting because, you know, mental health for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities is a big issue that's getting more and more attention here in recent years. And SDMI is another tool, right, that could be used to help support the mental health. So based upon your findings, you know, in the therapy context, right? How can SDMI be used to support the mental health for somebody with an intellectual or developmental disability?
Let's say we're working with a person, and I'm going to use person instead of client or patient. I'm going to use person. And they come to me for therapy. And let's say they're working on, their goal is to work on, give me a hypothetical situation, Jessica.
Well, in our article, we talk about Olivia and Maggie who are working together.
On depression or mood management. And it's like we can get them to set a goal and maybe the goal is to work on mood or depression management, and then we work through the steps on problem solving or how to accomplish that goal or how to refine that goal. So
SDMI is really more of an adjunct to something like cognitive behavioral therapy or acceptance and commitment therapy.
Possibly, yes.
Okay.
And it's the SDLMI.
SDLMI, sorry.
I think the way that we've kind of talked about it is like, and thought about it for this article too, is kind of like, there's a lot of like alignment is the word that comes to mind, that like, when you think about, you know, the stages that commonly go with cognitive behavioral therapy, which was kind of the model, the kind of therapy model that we were really thinking about, although there's lots of different models that this could be applied to, right? You have you have stages of CBT therapy or cognitive behavioral kind of therapy that line up. We were trying to kind of argue or propose with those stages and phases within the SDLMI. So kind of we have these similar kind of setup conversations about like, what's the purpose of the work we're going to do together? How are we going to do this work together? How do we agree to be kind of partners? And then we're thinking together about like, what is your goal? And we may be supporting that person thinking through like some of those educational types of supports and those kind of person questions, but also thinking about if what they want to learn and grow more on relates to kind of emotion management or self-management, then maybe there are some cognitive behavioral kinds of strategies that might be also supports and tools that we're introducing or offering as a person wants or needs them. And then together we're kind of evaluating, you know, what are the next steps to support and grow in the ways that you want to, and how are those things working?
It really well with cognitive behavioral therapy or any other theoretical orientation, but especially cognitive behavioral therapy, because they are both evidence-based practices.
Right, right. So it sounds like it's really a tool that can help individuals, people who are going through therapy, to take more ownership
of
kind of whatever's going on in their life, whether that's right emotions or particular personal goals or things they want to improve. It's just a more structured way of getting them to think through what does it mean to take that ownership. Would that be an accurate portrayal?
Yes. And I would say as a therapist too, it kind of holds me accountable to be like, am I really truly listening to what my client or what this person's goals are by using this kind of structured approach and questions? I think maybe historically in therapy, we've done more telling what to do and maybe less listening and supporting really and following someone's goals. And so I like this framework as a way to kind of hold myself as a therapist accountable to kind of keeping that person at the center and really thinking about their strengths and goals. So
that's awesome. That is something I think that is oftentimes missing. I think it's assumed sometimes that people are going to take ownership, and occasionally it's nice to have a more structured approach to help facilitate that. So we kind of touched on this earlier, that you were doing a lot of this work during the pandemic and everything. But one of the things we try to do on the podcast here is give people a picture of what happens behind the scenes, right? When you're writing an article and working on a research project. And there's always funny stories, events, awkward interactions, whatever it is that occur as you're working on a project. So I want each of you to think, if there were any memorable aspects of writing your article, funny events, exciting discoveries, new collaborations, are there anything memorable from this project that really stands out that you're like, oh, that was amazing?
Jessica, you're going to do that next. You go first.
Well, so I'm at KU, right? And we're in Kansas City. And so we had like a lot of, you know, there were lots of things happening in Kansas City, but in 2020, but we had a Super Bowl victory that happened in February before everything sort of really came to the United States. And I think one of the fun things I will remember from writing this paper is the fun kind of back and forth that a certain Buccaneers fan would tend to bring to our writing sessions. We would have kind of regular meetings and writing and brainstorming together. And you never knew, like, it's kind of depending how things went over the weekend, if someone was going to have a Tampa Bay Buccaneers background, you know, subtly post there, you know, when we were meeting. So some fun and friendly. And I'll admit, I wasn't paying a ton of attention to the NFL before the Chiefs were winning and stuff, but it was sure fun to be able to give each other a hard time during the writing process about, and kind of have something else to talk about besides just kind of work.
Oh, so you're a Buccaneers fan, Richard? I'm assuming that's you.
Yes, I am. and I don't really have a fun memory story, but it's like we would do a lot of co-writing over Zoom to like flesh out ideas, and that's really how I enjoyed to write.
That's actually pretty, that's pretty uncommon,
Yeah.
I find, to co-write simultaneously. You know, a lot of people like to do a draft, send it to the next person, the next person takes it. And so that's interesting.
And we did some of that, and I don't think it would be right to not acknowledge our team. I think
Yeah.
Absolutely.
we
Yeah.
had an incredible team behind us. So it's not just Jessica and I, and I'm trying to integrate all.
Yep. And there are like five authors on this article. We've
Yeah.
just got you and Jessica today.
I know.
But yeah, it was a big group, it looked like, who was involved with making this happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we really appreciated, obviously, Carrie's kind of guidance in the conceptualization and that expertise around the SDLMI, and also grateful to Shada Raley for her kind of contributions and feedback. And then we had some wonderful research assistants during this process. You know, as good people do, they moved on to like other training and other work, but we're really, really grateful for the work that Hannah Adams did, who's now a graduate student at George Mason University, and Sydney Walls, who now works at Stanford University in a research coordinator role there. So really, really great work, and we really, really appreciate them.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's always fun to see where people go, right, once they have these experiences. So what, kind of going back to the article, what is the main message that you would like readers to take from your article? If you were to sum it up in just a couple of sentences, what should people remember?
Self-determination is even part of the subset of positive psychology and invention. It's really a different way to, instead of using a deficit-based lens, focusing on a asset, using an asset-based lens to provide treatment to people.
Great, thank you. Would you add anything to that, Jessica?
Oh, I thought that was pretty well said.
Awesome.
I'm kind of putting my therapist hat on, but I think as someone who's kind of worked in this area for a few years now, I've heard too many times from families or from people that they, you know, tried to seek out therapy elsewhere in their community and were told like, "Oh, you have a developmental disability. I don't know how to do that," right? And so I guess a message I would have for therapists and counselors out there who maybe haven't worked with folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities before, like you can do this, and there's a lot of alignment with some of this with a lot of the tools or the practices that we talk about in maybe like disability spaces that can apply really well in mental health spaces. And that self-determination, as Richard said, is important for everyone. And so these kinds of practices are going to make all therapy stronger, I would say, like more helpful, hopefully more impactful, for more, and then when we can think in accessible ways, we can do that for more people too, which is really important.
Well, the mental health thing is a personal interest of mine, and I work on several projects related to it. And one of the most common things we hear from therapists is, I haven't been trained to work with this population. I don't know how to support their needs. Where would a therapist or any other, right, mental health professional go to learn more about the SDLMI?
We are developing resources as selfdetermination.org, where we are really, our next step is to develop a intervention manual based on this work, and we have some funding proposals out under review for that.
Awesome.
So yeah.
Yeah, did you? I think I, sorry, Richard, I don't know if I heard quite right, but the selfdetermination.ku.edu is a great resource, especially on the self-determination inventory and the self-determined learning model of instruction, and like the the SDLMI teacher's guide, which we reference a lot in the paper, is available there for download for free to learn more as well. But yeah, hopefully with some funding proposals out there, we'll have a manual to kind of guide folks from there.
A manual.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, we'll make sure that we provide a link to all those resources in the show notes for this so that people can go directly to find those, because, you know, that is the most common thing we hear, where people are looking for tools. And so, yeah, I think this is a really interesting one to get out there and make people. And it sounds like it's one that's relatively accessible, right? It's something that's pretty easy to implement in a clinical setting once you're familiar with it. Kind of get the context.
Yeah, there are training opportunities offered through KU if you to do them. I think there's a more intensive, like it's like 2 to 3 days of training for organizations to, if the, you know, like say a whole practice or a whole agency wanted to like kind of embed this practice on the whole. I think there's lots of great tools, and just even those guiding questions is a great place to start. Like, how can I embed some of those facilitator questions into the work I'm doing? I have another resource too. You guys can decide whether or not you want to share this or not. I have a Padlet website that I've started kind of compiling resources. It's they're all evidence-informed or evidence-based resources. But more kind of from my own like personal practice and then experiences and working with folks that I'd be happy to share too. It's tinyurl.com/SDEmpower. And I've just tried to put links to the SDLMI, for example, self-determination website, as well as some other evidence-based curriculum and modular treatments for anxiety or depression, tailored or developed for kids and young people with autism or other developmental disabilities. So it's not exhaustive, but I also have shared that with folks who are like, oh, I don't really know where to go or how to start, and kind of say, you can.
Well, we will put a link to it in the show notes. So here at the end, I like to end the show with two questions that we ask everybody. And just, again, it's trying to make the authors who write in the journal a little more human and help us understand kind of who you are as people. So the first question that I ask, and I'll give you each a chance to respond here. You know, we all end up doing disability work, mental health work, because of the huge paycheck. Oh, wait, no, that's wrong. We all have a reason that's motivated us to get in and do this work. So that's my question. What motivates you to do this work? Why do you do what you do? And why don't we start with you, Richard?
I've had great mentors, and in a lot of this is my combining my love of my, as a clinician, working with persons with disabilities, and then my being someone with lived experience.
That makes perfect sense. Most people have a personal connection, we find, as we do this. Jess, what about you?
Oh gosh, Richard, it's so hard to follow you. You always have such good... So I have some familial connections to folks with a variety of different kind of developmental differences. I think what gets me going every time I'm getting ready to go to clinic or working with students or getting to like work with Richard on a project or a paper like this is like, I really enjoy like seeing people grow, like, or supporting people and grow, you know, like having that moment of like, they didn't think they could do something and then they do it. And then you kind of go, you know, that celebration is like really, I don't know if I want to say this, it's like a drug kind of, right? Like you get like this high from being like, oh yes, we did this. You did this, you know, together, you know? So I maybe don't call it a drug. That's probably not a good thing for a podcast. But it's that feedback and that adrenaline of like feeling like you're really having an impact on someone individually. And then I think to feel like you are around people that you can work together to have some collective impact in some way is really powerful and exciting. And this idea that we can keep growing and getting better is it's important. We have a lot of work to do. So those little steps are huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it technically kind of is a drug, right? It's just a hormone response. It's dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, all those things that make us feel, wow, we're connected and life is good.
Yeah. The opportunity to like have a personal relation, you know, have a relationship with someone and then be a part of their journey to growth is like just awesome.
I would agree. So the last question here, one of the focuses of the journal, and we continue to work on this, is just trying to make this research more accessible and inclusive. So, you know, a great example is we try to have people with lived experience as reviewers, and we try to include self-advocate voices, and we try to make sure the journal is available in a variety of formats to make it, again, more accessible. So what are some things that you've each been doing to make your work more inclusive and accessible? And we're going to start with Jessica this time so that she doesn't have to follow you, Richard.
I am trying to listen as much as I can and respond and partner with voices of people with lived experience. As a person who doesn't necessarily identify as having a developmental disability or intellectual disability or autism, it's really important that the work I'm doing be as informed as possible. And I'm still learning and growing and staying open to that feedback. So I've appreciated so many of the opportunities of different collaborators, students, clients who have given me feedback that I've tried to learn and grow from, and have been very appreciative for, and appreciated even you all kind of charging us with writing a clear language summary. And I was just even thinking about our title and how it could maybe use a little work around clear language too. So I think getting feedback from the systems that we're engaging with too, to set those expectations is really also important. So we
appreciate that. Yeah. It's a challenge. It really is to make academic writing and research actually accessible to the general populace and then to make it accessible to people who may have intellectual disabilities or otherwise, it's a lot harder than it looks from the surface.
I'm focused on making my research more accessible and making sure when I exercise research, because it's an interesting thing. I have lived experience, but I also identify as a researcher. So I want to make sure that I include in my research person with lived experience as well. I have that dual positionality, which is very interesting.
It is. It absolutely is. And yet I think it's so incredibly valuable and greatly appreciative for the opportunity that we've had to work with you, Richard and Jessica, and to publish your work. It's actually really, I've really enjoyed reading and learning and just talking with you today. I think there's just some great information there in the article. So I'd encourage everyone to go check it out. We'll provide a link in the show notes and hopefully we can get more people reaching out, trying to learn about the SDLMI. See, I said it right there.
There you go. Awesome.
Cool.
Okay, so that's it for our conversation with Richard and Jessica today. I would like to thank all of you for listening this far. I hope that you learned something through that conversation. I would like to thank here at the end the DDNJ Managing Editor and Author Insights podcast producer, Alex Shewall, for her hard work to get this podcast out. Alex does a vast majority of the work, the public-facing work of DDNJ, and so she's an invaluable member of our team here. We'd also like to thank the USU Institute for Disability Research Policy and Practice for their financial and in-kind support for this podcast and journal. And we'd also like to thank the Utah State University Libraries and Digital Commons, who also support the Developmental Disabilities Network Journal. As I mentioned earlier, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Please leave us a rating and a review. Share it with your colleagues. Help get this information out there. So you can learn more about the Developmental Disabilities Network Journal at our website, which is digitalcommons.usu.edu/DDNJ. And you can download podcast transcripts in English and Spanish and learn more about our podcast guests at our podcast page, which is linked in the show notes. So I'd like to thank you all so much for tuning in. Thank you for the good work that you do. You're making a difference. We want you to know that what you do matters. And please stay tuned for our next episode. Thanks all. Have a great rest of your day.